Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. In 2010, the Supreme Court issued a decision in the Citizens United case, which tossed out the corporate and union ban on making independent donations and financing electioneering communications. This gave corporations and unions the green light to spend unlimited sums on ads and other political tools, calling for the election or defeat of individual candidates. The court said it's okay for corporations to spend as much as they want to convince people to vote for or against a candidate. The Citizens United decision has helped open the floodgates for corporate spending on elections, threatening our democracy. Citizens are not taking this lying down, but mobilizing to challenge Citizens United. Our guest today is a leader in the fight to overturn the Citizens United decision. John Bonifaz is the co-founder and executive director of Free Speech for People, a national nonpartisan campaign that works to challenge the misuse of corporate power and to restore Republican democracy to the people. Mr. Bonifaz previously served as the executive director and general counsel of the National Voting Rights Institute, which he founded in 1994 to protect the rights of all citizens to vote and participate in the electoral process equally. Mr. Bonifaz also previously served as the legal director of Voter Action, a national election integrity organization. Mr. Bonifaz is a 1992 cum laude graduate of Harvard Law School and a 1999 recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. John Bonifaz, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great. I'm excited to be able to talk with you today and find out more about the great work that you're doing. Can you explain to our listeners what is the Citizens United ruling and why is it a danger to our republic?
Yes. The Citizens United ruling is a January 2010 ruling of the United States Supreme Court, which equated corporations as people with political speech rights under the First Amendment and swept away a century of precedent barring corporate money in our elections. This is a case that actually did not get presented in the first instance as one to sweep away this century of tradition, but rather a case that came about because of an organization known as Citizens United, a Virginia-based advocacy group, wanting to air a movie that it had created in the 2008 presidential cycle called Hillary the Movie. And it was designed to attack then-presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's run in the 2008 primaries, and they wanted to air the movie as well as ads for the movie, 30 and 60 second ads that were clearly designed to target her campaign in a negative way. The McCain-Feingold law, known as the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, passed on a bipartisan basis by U.S. Congress in 2002, had prohibited corporate funding of these kinds of ads before a primary election, before a general election. And they, the Citizens United group, sought to test the constitutionality of that specific provision in court. And when they got before the Supreme Court in the spring of 2009, they made the argument on these technical grounds. This was really a very technical campaign finance case. And then five justices of the Supreme Court decided to transform it into this vehicle for sweeping away a century of precedent. They ordered new argument on issues that had not been presented in the trial court, had not been presented in the factual record, and that new argument was essentially whether prior precedent barring corporate money in elections altogether should be overturned. And as a result of this ruling, 5-4 ruling, we now have unlimited corporate money coming into our elections. The rise of the super PACs, because this ruling led to a subsequent ruling of an appellate court that allowed for these super PACs to emerge. And we really have this huge threat now posed to the integrity of our elections and our democracy, where ordinary citizen voices are getting drowned out by big money forces and corporate forces that are threatening our government.
That sounds very scary, and we saw in this most recent election last year just really hundreds of millions of dollars being spent. You know, how much different do you think the Citizens United case made in the election last year?
Well, we certainly know that as a result of the Citizens United ruling, we saw over $1 billion in outside spending come in to this last election cycle. Demos and U.S. PIRG put together a very important report that can be accessed via their websites about the impact, documenting this kind.
When you say outside groups, you're talking about groups that are not in the Democratic or Republican parties?
Right. These are independent organizations largely backed by corporate and big money forces or super PACs. And these now have an enormous influence over our elections, and much of this money does not have to be disclosed in any way, so we don't always know the sources. The other reality coming out of Citizens United is that there is a huge amount of money that might not ever be tracked. So while the U.S. PIRG and Demos report track some of this, there's a lot that we don't know because of the fact there's no disclosure requirement. But, you know, we did have a problem. I want to be clear to your listeners. We had a problem prior to Citizens United with money in politics. There's no question about it. We had over $5 billion spent in the 2008 cycle. But this has been made exponentially worse by now a system that allows unlimited corporate money and unlimited big money into our elections. The Fortune 100 companies in 2008 alone made $600 billion in profits. If they just spent 2% of those profits on our elections, they more than double all that was spent in 2008 and 2012. So this is what's at their disposal now, and elected officials at all levels of government, federal, state, and local, know that. And so it's even the threat of the expenditure that's causing the undermining of our democratic process, because any public official now knows that if they dare to go up against a corporate interest on behalf of the public interest, they too might be targeted with this kind of independent corporate expenditure. And that is just as much of a danger to our democracy and our political process as the actual expenditure itself.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the description of this case around Citizens United that the corporations are now given equal rights of free speech along with people. Did I hear that right?
You did, and you know, I think that's a critical point to make, right, which is that this is not solely a campaign finance ruling, as important and dangerous as it is for the sake of our elections. This is also a ruling that extends a fabricated doctrine of corporate constitutional rights to its most extreme extent. This is a doctrine that emerged under the First Amendment really back in 1971 when Lewis Powell, a private corporate attorney then working for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, wrote a memorandum never designed to see the light of day. It was supposed to be a secret memorandum for the chamber to articulate how corporate America could respond to the growing number of public interest laws getting passed in that era to protect our environment, our health care, civil rights, consumer rights. And Lewis Powell's response via this memorandum was to put forward a strategy by which corporate America would go into federal court and argue a free speech claim, that corporations have a free speech right that's being violated by these public interest laws. He then, of course, became Justice Lewis Powell, nominated by then-President Nixon, confirmed by the Senate without any knowledge of this memorandum's existence. And he became an architect of this corporate speech doctrine on the U.S. Supreme Court. And Justice Rehnquist, you know, by no means seen as a liberal justice, one of the more conservative justices of the modern era, he was a constant dissenter, consistently dissenting on this idea that corporations should be treated as people with political rights. But unfortunately, he did not win the day. Lewis Powell would win in these divided rulings and successively began to strike down these public interest laws on this fabricated doctrine of corporate speech. And that's where we got Citizens United. It was an extension of that doctrine. It is true that this idea of corporations being treated as people goes back to 1886, when a ruling that really didn't even have it in the text of the ruling dealing with railroad taxation, but articulated in the headnotes that somehow the justices believed corporations had due process rights. And that was subsequently followed by other cases in that era. But by the time of the New Deal, this whole doctrine had become dormant and was resurrected by Lewis Powell when he got to the U.S. Supreme Court.
It sounds like the resurrection of the vampire here. I mean, this is just to an average layperson, and I know you're deep into this issue and you're a brilliant lawyer and a Harvard Law graduate, but just to an average person to say that corporations are like people and they deserve the right to free speech, which we get protected by in the Constitution, sounds absolutely ludicrous.
It is ludicrous, and it represents a direct threat to the promise of government of, by, and for the people. For example, Monsanto argues that we do not have a right to know what's in our food. We do not have a right to have GMO labeling of genetically modified organisms, because they, Monsanto, as a corporation, have somehow a free speech right that prevents them from being forced to label their food products where GMOs are located. That is the extent to which this doctrine undermines self-government. The National Labor Relations Board has a new notice they want to require employers to put throughout their workplaces about the right to strike, the right to collectively bargain, the right to a union. And the response by corporate America has been to go into court and say, no, we have a free speech right not to put those notices in our workplaces. And they've won thus far before the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. The rating agencies that rate Wall Street products that created fraudulent ratings that led us in part to the 2008 financial crisis that's created the economic problems we have today, those rating agencies, when challenged, say they have a First Amendment right to express these opinions, as they put it, and they shouldn't be held accountable for making fraudulent claims around the ratings of these kinds of Wall Street products. Those are the kinds of examples by which, when we try to govern over these artificial creatures of the state, which is what corporations are, they respond by somehow claiming constitutional rights that are designed really only for we the people. The framers never intended to have these artificial creatures of the state have the same rights as you and I.
No, that's clearly true. And legally, isn't it true that corporations actually exist only because they're chartered by the state in which they're registered?
That's absolutely right. I mean, they don't have a right to exist. They only have an ability to exist because we allow them to exist. It's a privilege to get those incorporation papers, and it's a privilege that comes with a lot of benefits: limited liability, perpetual life, the ability to aggregate wealth and distribute wealth. And for those reasons, the framers understood that they were not to be treated as people. James Madison spoke of corporations as, quote, a necessary evil subject to proper limitations and guards. Thomas Jefferson said he, quote, hoped to crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations. And for two centuries, the U.S. Supreme Court and the federal courts below it followed the framers' mandate under the First Amendment and never recognized anything such as a corporate speech right. This is a fabrication, a fiction that has really only existed under the First Amendment for the past 30-some years, but is now coming directly into our democratic process via the Citizens United ruling.
This is really scary. It's like the creeping power of the corporations now kind of coming in and into this whole arena of our Constitution. And I had never drawn the connection between the Citizens United decision with the fight around Monsanto, but now that you mention that, you know, for people who don't realize it, about 40% of our food now comes from crops that were designed genetically modified organisms that companies sell and the farmer has to buy every year, and there's no evidence really that it provides greater yields, and it basically creates perpetual dependence by the farmers, and there's no evidence that shows that it's safe to eat, and yet 40% of our crops are now under this genetically modified organisms in our corn and wheat and whatever. But now you're saying Monsanto is using the Citizens United decision to say, even if people want to know if they have genetically modified organisms on their food, that no, the consumers don't have a right to know that because we, Monsanto, the corporation, have a right to free speech, and our right to free speech is the right to not tell you what kind of crops we have here.
That's exactly their argument. And, you know, the reality is that they've used it successfully already prior to Citizens United. So they're bolstered by Citizens United. But on the road to Citizens United, there was a very important case out of Vermont in which the state of Vermont, through its legislature and through its citizens, sought to require labeling of the bovine growth hormone drug, which is a Monsanto drug that they created to arguably increase efficiency in milk production. And in the 1990s, this was a drug that they were promoting around the world, but they were running into fierce resistance because of concerns around the impact to human health and animal health. And so large parts of the world were banning the use of this drug in milk production. Australia banned it altogether. Europe banned it. Canada banned it. But because of the capture that the industry has over our governmental agencies here in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration refused to ban it and rather fast-tracked it for use here in this country. And so organic dairy farmers, alarmed by the fact this drug was being allowed to be used in the U.S., organic dairy farmers in Vermont decided to go to their legislature with concerned citizens alongside them and argue that at least let's label these products coming from dairies using this drug. Let's require that we understand as a people, as a public in Vermont, whether or not you want to buy a milk product from a dairy using this drug on their cows, or whether you want to buy a milk product from the many organic dairies in the state of Vermont. And so they got that law passed. It was a labeling requirement. What did Monsanto do through the Industrial Dairy Association? They sued the state of Vermont. In the 1990s, they sued them in federal court, and they won at the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. They won a ruling that struck down that Vermont law on this very free speech argument that they had a right not to speak, and therefore they didn't have to put these labels on their products. And that's, again, you know, on the road to Citizens United, but Monsanto is using this argument yet again in this GMO labeling fight. And, you know, there are states that are pushing back, but I think it's only a matter of time when we'll see Monsanto in court again trying to apply this fabricated argument to strike down these laws.
Holy cow, this is just, you know, even more devastating than what I had thought. I mean, clearly the Citizens United decision is having a dramatic influence on our elections when corporations can have the right to spend unlimited amounts of money and influence who's going to run and who's going to win. And it's not just influencing our elections so dramatically, but really every sphere of our life, including what we eat and what we know about what we eat.
Yes, and, you know, really at its core, this is a question of what are we as a nation? Is it we the people or is it we the corporations? Do we govern over corporations, or is it now the other way around? That's ultimately the question here. And yes, we need to safeguard our elections. That's a critical piece of this. But the full story is one in which we have to look at the whole panoply set of arguments that these artificial creatures of the state use to try to advance their interests for their bottom line rather than, you know, uphold what is clearly designed for the Constitution, which is to protect we the people. And that's what's at stake in this fight. It's a power struggle, a struggle between people governing ourselves, American self-government, of government, of, for, and by the people, or having a corporatocracy where we basically are subjected to corporate dominance of our political process and of our government.
Well, as Frederick Douglass once said, power concedes nothing without struggle. And given this big power grab that's happening by the corporations, what do you think that we the people can do to get restore our control over these creatures of the state?
Well, at Free Speech for People, we're engaged in three major strategies to push back against Citizens United and to restore democracy to the people and defend our republic. Number one is we're helping to catalyze and lead this growing movement for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, to overturn this fabricated doctrine of corporate constitutional rights. And since we've launched this campaign on the day of the Citizens United ruling, we've seen enormous traction with our allies in the field, Common Cause, People for the American Way, Public Citizen, U.S. PIRG, and Move to Amend, and many other groups. We've seen enormous traction in this movement. 16 states are now on record calling for a constitutional amendment, having either passed legislative resolutions or having gotten on the ballot in Montana and Colorado, where we helped to push on the ballot these kinds of resolutions and the voters passing them overwhelmingly. In addition to those 16 states, there are 500 plus cities and towns that have gone on record calling for an amendment, including major cities like Los Angeles and New York, Seattle and Boston. There are 2,000 plus business leaders across the country who've joined this call, because small business leaders understand that they're not going to have any level playing field up against the big multinational corporations in this kind of corporatocracy that we're facing. And elected officials at all levels of government, including over 125 members of Congress and the President of the United States, have come on board for an amendment. So we're one-third of the way there in terms of getting an amendment ratified. One-third of the Congress,
When you say one-third of the way there, can you describe exactly what does it take? I mean, it's a huge haul to get a constitutional amendment. Specifically, what do we need to do to accomplish a constitutional amendment?
Yes. So under Article 5 of the Constitution, we have the power to amend the Constitution via two different routes. One is to amend it by going through the United States Congress. Two-thirds of the House of Representatives, two-thirds of the Senate need to pass a constitutional amendment bill and send it to the states for ratification. Then three-quarters of the states, 38 states, need to ratify. That is the one way we've amended the Constitution in all of our history. So all of our 27 amendments to the Constitution have been achieved that way. The other route that the Constitution provides that's never been used is the route of a constitutional convention, where you have the states calling for a convention, and then out of the convention comes one or more amendment bills that go to the states for ratification. You know, we are not involved in calling for a convention. We do certainly recognize that the 17th Amendment to the Constitution, which transferred the election of U.S. senators from state legislatures, where there were entrenched power problems, to the people themselves, that occurred in part because of the threat of a convention. But at this point, we're focused, along with our allies, in pushing for an amendment bill out of Congress. And we already have champions in the United States Senate and in the U.S. House. And if you go to freespeechforpeople.org, you'll see the two amendment bills we support, one of which is the People's Rights Amendment that we helped to draft, that Senator John Tester of Montana and Congressman Jim McGovern of Massachusetts are partnering on. And then the other is Senator Tom Udall's amendment bill we call the Political Equality Amendment Bill, that would overturn a prior Supreme Court ruling known as Buckley v. Valeo that equated money with speech and set us on this course of unlimited campaign spending. And his amendment that Congressman McGovern has also championed in the House would allow for states and Congress to set reasonable campaign spending limits, mandatory limits on overall spending in elections.
Okay, great. So, John, you were saying that free speech for people has three strategies to push back on this corporate power grab, and one of them is this constitutional amendment that would overturn Citizens United. Are there two others?
There are. So the other two deal with pushing back in the courts against Citizens United and this fabricated doctrine of corporate constitutional rights. We've just launched a legal advocacy program where we will be engaged even more so than we have already in pushing back in the courts, identifying dissenting voices within the judiciary that will come forward and make clear that Citizens United was wrong and that this doctrine is wrong. We, in launching this program, have a number of respected scholars, former judges, law professors, attorneys around the country joining us and backing this effort. And then the third strategy is one that advances new reforms of corporate charter laws and other tools for holding corporations accountable to the public. So, for example, we're advocating in Arkansas and in other states that states use the power they have to condition the privileges they provide corporations on the prohibition of making corporate political expenditures. And specifically in Arkansas, we've lined up with Common Cause and Public Citizen and Regnat Populus, a group in Arkansas, to advocate that the state of Arkansas, through the ballot, the voters pass a law making clear that limited liability protection will only be provided as a privilege to those corporations that abide by a prohibition on corporate political expenditures, and that if they want that privilege of limited liability protection, they should not engage in distorting the election process in the state of Arkansas. That kind of idea, we think, needs to be advanced in other states as a way for states to address Citizens United through another route while we continue to build this amendment movement and while we push back in the courts.
So, you know, we have just about 1 minute before our break here, but are you saying that states can use this ability because the companies have to get chartered by the state, that the state can say, we will only charter you, Mr. Corporation, if you're not spending money to influence us politically?
Well, we actually go beyond the chartering question. So what we're saying is that if you want to do business in a state like Arkansas, and you want that limited liability protection, whether you're chartered somewhere else or whether you're chartered in Arkansas, you want that limited liability protection for doing business in Arkansas, then like all other corporations in the state of Arkansas, you'll be treated the same, which is you'll get that privilege provided that you abide by a prohibition on making political expenditures in our state, which was, as I emphasized, you know, was the state that we had before Citizens United. States were allowed to bar corporate money in elections. And in fact, in Montana, the state of Montana had a law since 1910 on the ballot that barred corporate money in elections. For a century, it worked. It was put on the books, in Montana because of the Copper Baron era, where copper barons were controlling Montana government, Montana politics. And then, of course, Citizens United came out, and to the credit of then Attorney General Steve Bullock, now the governor of Montana, he went before U.S. Congress, he testified and said, I'm going to keep enforcing this law. You know, there is a reason why we've had a century of practice and tradition of barring corporate money elections, and I'm going to keep it the way it is. And if you want to challenge me in court, I dare anyone to come challenge. So a set of corporate interests did challenge him in court. We came to his defense. He won a state Supreme Court ruling out of Montana in December of 2011, where all seven justices went on record saying Citizens United was wrong, and five of them were willing to uphold the law. And then it went straight to the U.S. Supreme Court, and without even hearing an argument on the merits, without even having the factual record presented, they reversed the state Supreme Court and allowed that century-old law to be struck down. So this is now another answer for states like Montana and Arkansas and elsewhere to say, well, if the court is going to treat us without any, you know, hearing on the factual record as to why we need this kind of prohibition, then we'll go ahead and condition the privilege that we provide of limited liability protection to corporations on this prohibition. And that will then have to be a new argument that corporations will make in the courts as to somehow why they should maintain that privilege at the same time that they are distorting the election process in these states.
All right, hold that thought. We're going to pause now for the break. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, John Bonifaz, on All Together Now. Hello, welcome back. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now. I'm speaking with my guest, John Bonifaz, the co-founder and executive director of Free Speech for People. We're talking about the biggest power grab by U.S. corporations in history. And just before the break, John, you were telling us that Montana valiantly tried to defend its law, but was overturned by the Supreme Court. So, you know, isn't this why we need a constitutional amendment? I mean, even if we take action in the state level, aren't we just going to keep getting slammed down at the federal level by the Supreme Court?
Well, I think we need to certainly push for a constitutional amendment, continue that push. There's no question that that's a critical fight. But I also think we need to keep pushing back in the courts. You know, the courts need to deal with these questions and be forced to answer time and time again why it is that corporations should be treated as people with constitutional rights and why somehow these laws that have been on the books for over a century should be just swept away. You know, it may be that there's a judicial nomination fight for a Supreme Court nominee. These questions should come up in that fight if it happens in the near future. You know, judicial nomination fights at the federal court levels below the Supreme Court, these questions should come up. So I think there's a lot of areas where we should be engaged in pushing back here. But yes, you know, we do need to continue the constitutional amendment movement. And, you know, we've been proud to join with our allies in helping to lead that movement. We'll continue to do so. And the Arkansas, you know, ballot measure not only deals with this idea of limited liability protection being tied to the prohibition, but would also call for a constitutional amendment. And it would be the first southern state to do so if it passed. So we're going to keep building that movement as we also engage in these other strategies.
Very good. And, you know, I'm wondering, do we have any sense of who's behind this on the corporation side? I mean, clearly, every corporation could stand to benefit when it can use its money to influence the political system and control what we know about the products that they're selling us and so forth. But do we know, can you name names of companies or people that are, like, spearheading this drive?
Well, I think what happened with the Lewis Powell memorandum back in 1971 is it really was a concerted effort by the largest corporations in the United States through the U.S. Chamber to deal with this growing number of public interest laws passed at that time. And since then, I think they've stayed engaged. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the tobacco industry, for example, takes advantage of this doctrine when they want to strike down new regulations dealing with labeling of tobacco products. You know, major corporations are using this doctrine for their financial benefit at the expense of the public interest, and they're doing it time and time again. But I do think, you know, this is not something that's being pushed by the small business community. If anything, the small business community recognizes the threats posed by this doctrine, because it is both a threat to our elections, it's a threat to our self-government, it's also a threat to a competitive marketplace, to an innovative economy. You know, when you have the largest multinational corporations being able to control and set public policy, determine, you know, which kind of playing field there is going to be, that effectively allows for crony capitalism and undermines the ability of a little guy and a small business owner to make it in that kind of economy. So, you know, I think this is in the interest of the largest corporations up against everybody else, and they're the ones who are behind it.
Yeah, well, you know, what can we do? You're a brilliant lawyer, Harvard Law grad, with a lot of experience. You're very articulate and very strategic. What can our listeners do? Like, what can we, the people, do to support this effort and roll back this big power grab by the corporations?
Well, Eleanor, I appreciate your kind words. You know, it really is going to take a collective effort by all of us all around the country. Millions of Americans have already been standing up, and we'd love to have more join this effort at freespeechforpeople.org to sign up, to visit our resources page, download action kit, organizing toolkit to help get involved. You know, there are local town resolutions that are getting introduced all the time. And if you're in a community that has not yet taken up this question, to go before your local town, your city council, your community board, whatever it may be, and urge that they go on record calling for this amendment to reclaim our democracy. And then if you're in a state that has yet to get on record, because they're obviously out of the, you know, remaining number of states, there's many more that we need to get on board beyond the 16. If you're in one of those states, you know, we urge you to go before your state legislature. Call your own local state representative, your own state senator. Ask him or her to co-sponsor or sponsor a resolution in the state legislature calling for an amendment. You know, there are other ways for people to get involved in terms of video content that we provide on our site that people can show at their homes, invite their friends and neighbors in to help educate people about this problem. And, you know, really what this is going to take is the creative imagination and will of all of us, we the people, to defend our democracy. But I will say we've done it before in our nation's history. This is not like the first time we faced a serious threat to our democracy. You know, women did not get the right to vote in this country because men in power thought it was a good idea. They organized, they fought, and they died for the 19th Amendment to the Constitution guaranteeing women the right to vote. Labor did not make its gains in the 1930s because big business you know, thought in power that it was a good idea. They organized a labor movement. They won minimum wage laws and workplace safety laws and so forth. And we didn't bring down Jim Crow South and the segregation, racial segregation in this country because whites in power thought it was a good idea. It was the civil rights movement that did that. So there are many examples in our past where we have gone up against historically entrenched power, and we have won. But it's because of a grassroots movement organized over time with the determination and will of the people to lift up that promise of American self-government of, by, and for the people, and lift up that promise of political equality for all. And that's what we have to reinvigorate today all across this country. And people are doing it. People are standing up across the political spectrum in defense of our democracy.
That's fabulous, very moving. And so I encourage our listeners to check out your website, freespeechbypeople.org, and learn more about this issue and see what's happening already in your area. And if something's not happening, you can be the one to get it going, because it sounds like unless we, the people, take action, it's them, the corporations, that are going to be really kind of ruling the roost here. And it's a scary situation, really.
It is. And, yes, freespeechforpeople.org is where you can connect with us. But, you know, I also just want to, you know, add to this point of how it's possible for us to prevail here. Beyond looking at the history, I often like to tell the story of Doris Haddock, otherwise known as Granny D. Some of your listeners may know she decided at the age of 89 to walk across the country to overhaul our nation's campaign finance system. She set out from California walking 10 miles a day. She didn't have any grand plan as to how she was going to do this, how she was going to be housed, how she was going to be fed. She just started to walk. And random strangers came out of their homes. They housed her. They fed her. They walked with her for part of the way. She walked through the rain, through the wind, through the snow. She cross-country skied in places, 3,200 miles later, 14 months later, turning 90 in the process. She reached Washington, D.C. to be greeted by then-Senator Russ Feingold and Senator John McCain, hundreds of others there that day. I was honored to have been among those greeting her that day, and I was honored to have known her and to have worked with her. And she passed away at the age of 100 in March of 2010, 2 months after the Citizens United ruling. And, you know, when she heard about that ruling, she thought about walking across the country again. But when she passed away, I thought about the fact that when she was born, when she was born, the 19th Amendment guaranteeing women the right to vote had yet to be enacted. She saw in her lifetime 9 amendments passed by 2/3 of the Congress, ratified by 3/4 of the states. She is an example that change can happen in a lifetime, including a constitutional amendment. In the name of Granny D, it is time for a 28th Amendment to the Constitution to lift up that promise of American democracy and make clear that we the people rule.
Fantastic. Now, it seems as more information comes out about this that we really need people to be running for office, you know, state rep, state senator, and for Congress, so this gets on the agenda in Congress. So, you know, I'm here in D.C. right now, and what they're talking about is the big battle. Will the Republicans prevent government from working because the Republicans yet again want to block Obamacare, and they're willing to shut the government down unless Obamacare is repealed, and they're not going to be passing the continuing resolution to, you know, fund the government unless Obamacare is repealed. So, you know, it shows the power. There's just about 40 of these Tea Party members of Congress, and they've totally shifted the debate in the U.S. House and in the Congress and in politics generally, just with 40 people. What if we got 40 people who went into Congress with the idea what we want to do is promote this overturn of Citizens United and restoring free speech for people? I mean, that would have a huge impact, wouldn't it?
It would, Eleanor, and it's a very good point. I mean, the fact is we're going into another national election in 2014 with congressional races all over the country. This should be a subject in every race. You know, people should be asked if they're running for public office at the federal level or even at the state level, where do they stand on this question? Do they support a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, making clear that corporations are not people with constitutional rights? Do they believe that we ought to get big money out of our politics and have reasonable campaign spending limits and other measures like public funding of elections and disclosure, shareholder accountability? You know, where do they stand? What side are they on? Those questions ought to be posed to these candidates on both sides of the aisle, wherever they may be, whether they're running as an independent, minor party, whatever affiliation. They should be asked these questions, and it should come up in any debates that occur. And I think the more that happens, the more we'll see that people are going to respond to candidates who stand up for our democracy and stand up for we the people over we the corporations.
Yeah, very good. And, you know, this whole thing began with this Buckley versus Vallejo case. Can you?
Yes.
Talk just a little bit of, like, when was that case? And this is the supposedly the legal underpinnings of this whole argument, which is ridiculous on the face of it, that corporations have a right to free speech. But what happened in that case that set us off track so badly?
Right. Well, this is a case that came about right after the Watergate era. So during Watergate, of course, one of the big scandals was the fact that there was all this hush money, cash, going through the Nixon White House. And as a result of all that corruption, Congress passed in 1974 amendments to the Fair Elections, FECA, the Fair Elections Congressional Act. And that those amendments were designed to create overall limits in our elections in terms of campaign spending, as well as contribution limits and some other measures. And the response to that law passed in the Watergate era was to go into court by those who looked at themselves as free speech absolutists tied with the corporate interests, and to argue that money equaled speech, and therefore these kinds of limits ought to be struck down. And what the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals said, the federal appellate court just below the Supreme Court that heard this case, they said that, in fact, this was a reasonable time, place, and manner regulation on speech, that this was not, in fact, a direct regulation on speech itself, and therefore they upheld both the contribution limits and the spending limits. And then the Supreme Court took up the question. And without any opportunity to see the law go into effect, so this was all hypothetical. It was just, you know, based on the law itself without any practice of the law being in effect. The Supreme Court ruled that, in fact, the contribution limits could be upheld on the grounds that it prevented corruption or the appearance of corruption. But the spending limits had to be struck down because spending money was a form of free speech, and therefore there should be no limits whatsoever on the expenditure of money. And the problem with that ruling, of course, is it effectively allows those with large sums of money to drown out the voices of ordinary citizens. There is no First Amendment right to drown out the voices of others, and yet the Supreme Court effectively allowed that in that ruling of Buckley v. Valeo, and they set us on this course of unlimited campaign spending. Had we gotten the Supreme Court in 1976 to uphold that law, we would have had mandatory spending limits in our elections, and we would not have seen this skyrocketing cost of our elections. We would not have seen elections become auctions up for the highest bidder. But that's what's happened. And then you combine that with the Citizens United ruling, and you make it exponentially worse, because now it's not just about individually rich people who can engage in drowning out voices of ordinary citizens, but it's about big corporate forces that can now do that as well. And those two rulings taken together pose this direct threat to our elections.
Yes, and that's a critical point. You know, here in D.C., you see it every day. You see the limos, you see the events, there's, you know, fundraisers up the wazoo every day. Just the money that's in this town to influence the members of Congress or people who are in bureaucracies even to influence how they vote. And it just gets harder and harder for individuals who don't have the money to pay the $1,000 or $10,000 or whatever it's costing for the price of entry to get in and talk to the members of Congress. You know, we just keep getting drowned out and lost in the picture. So I so appreciate the work that you're doing to try to get it back to the whole foundations of our democracy, is that we are governed by those that we elect, and that those elected representatives actually represent we the people. And it's very concerning that there's unlimited money out there for individuals, and even more concerning that now corporations can join the fray and take their billions, in some cases hundreds of billions of dollars, to influence which way our elections go. So I so appreciate the great work that you do, John, and encourage our listeners to check out the freespeechforpeople.org and get involved in this before it's too late.
Well, thank you, Eleanor. I appreciate that. And, you know, I do think that what we're dealing with here is really the promise of American self-government, the promise of democracy. Years ago, I remember seeing on television when I was early on in this field some 20 years ago, a NBC broadcast outside a Hollywood mansion where there was a major fundraiser happening for then President Clinton and his reelection. And this is to emphasize, you know, this is a bipartisan fight here. Democrats as well as Republicans are engaged in raising big money. And at this particular fundraiser, they raised $10 million that night from Hollywood celebrities and producers and actors and so forth. And NBC News did something very rare for mainstream television. They staked themselves outside this fundraiser, and they tried to get people to answer questions about the campaign finance process and what they thought of it. And no one wanted to answer the reporters' questions. They jumped into their limos, dashed away, except for one person who was a co-host of the fundraiser, Barbara Streisand. Mm-hmm. And I tell this story with full disclosure. She's been a donor and supporter of the work I've been doing over the years, and yet she did give this interview, and it was striking what happened here. The reporter asked her, "What do you think about this process of candidates having to raise large sums of money in order to compete for public office?" And she looked a little puzzled, you know, by that question. She wasn't expecting it. She began to back away from the camera and the reporter, and then she said, well, they can vote. You know, voters can vote. And I think that really spells it out, right? Because the fact is our right to vote is far more than the right to simply cast that ballot on election day. It's a right to an equal and meaningful vote. And that includes equal and meaningful participation in the entire election process, not just on election day. And when you have big money forces effectively selecting the candidates who are viable, who can then be put on the ballot, who can be competitive, and then we just ultimately are left with the vote, and that's the only thing we have, even when our candidates of choice don't have a chance, that's not really democracy. You know, that's essentially an exclusionary wealth primary that happens before the general election, before the primary election, that decides which candidates are viable. And so we need to move away from that and get to a place where it's not about big money that influences who gets elected, but it's about what are your ideas for your community, your state, your country, and that's front and center for the voters, and that the voters have an equal voice in our government and in our elections.
Absolutely, and it is something that brings some measure of comfort anyway that, you know, and myself having been involved in helping to run elections, that really the reason candidates need money is because they need to get the votes from the people. And obviously, if you have more money, you're more able to get your message out and your name out and have more people able to know you. But at the same time, money doesn't always win, and that ultimately we, the people, do have the right to vote, and we can vote someone in or out of office. But it really requires us to be informed about who's out there, who's running, and know who's backing some of these people that are being put up to be voted for. So, and you're talking about even upstream, who do we even look at as potential to vote for? So I think this money issue is absolutely essential if we want to reclaim our democracy. And I need to ask you just before we sign off, we just have another minute here, but what gives you the greatest hope about the future?
You know, really, what gives me the greatest hope is the willingness of people to stand up and fight back. And really, over the course of our history, I think we've seen that. And I'm seeing it now. Everywhere I go, there are people hungry to stand up and fight for our democracy. That's what gives me the greatest hope. Every time I meet somebody who wants to stand up in their community and fight, and demand an equal say and demand the promise of American self-government, I'm ready to stand, you know, with that person. And I think there are people all over the country who are doing that.
That's awesome. And I salute you, John, for the great work that you're doing to reclaim our democracy.
Thank you, Eleanor. It was a pleasure talking with you.
That's all the time we have. And if you, the listener, would like to learn more about John Bonifaz's great work, please check out freespeechforpeople.org. John, thanks for coming on the program. I hope to have you back so we can have an update on that campaign soon.
I would love it, Eleanor. Thank you so much.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they are available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Next week, my co-host, Charlene Spritnick, will be here with her guest, Anna LaPay, author of Diet for a Hot Planet. I'll be back 2 weeks from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.